Thank you, David. Thanks for coming. Pleasure to be here. So I'm one of the organizers of this program that is called Stochastic Geometry and Field Theory from Gross Phenomena to Disordered Systems. When we first thought about organizing this thing, we realized that there was something new in the air, if you want. And it seemed to be connecting a lot of different stuff. So if you look at the description of our program on the web, it seems to be extremely broad. And we believe that there's some unity between the different fields that are going to be represented in this program. Before I try to convince you what the unity might be, in fact, I mean, I don't think it's going to be enough to have one lecture to try to understand whether the unity is coming up or not. So I will probably ask David to give us two or three blackboard slots for our program. And today I will concentrate on just part of this whole story. So field theory has been a very useful instrument in many physical areas, and I assume more or less that more or less everybody here is at least vaguely familiar with what it means. So I'm actually removing it from my agenda today. Okay. So field theory is not going to be part of the story today. Well, some aspects of it maybe. And also I will remove disordered systems. It's a huge topic in itself, and so somebody else hopefully will be speaking about this later. So I'll talk about stochastic geometry and gross phenomena. So what is stochastic geometry? So first of all, let's break it down. So geometry. So we talk about shapes. We observe various things in the nature, and they have some shapes, and we want to characterize them in some way. So typical characterizations involve, I don't know, dimensions, typical scales. Sometimes dimensions are fractal dimensions, areas, volumes, you name it. So there are lots of different examples that can be studied, and let me just put up a few of them right away so that we have an idea of what might be studied using the Mesillian related concepts. So I will list them here. So critical and maybe non-critical, I don't know. Clusters and interfaces in StatMac. So you can imagine an Ising model with plus and minus spins, and those are separated by boundaries. And I don't specifically mean two dimensions. It can be happening in any number of dimensions. And these are pretty complicated things, especially at the critical point, of course, they're pretty much fractal, and I would like to understand what they are. So let me give you a second example. So growing clusters in non-equilibrium deviations. So there are many types of these clusters that grow. Well, one example you can have in mind is your car battery. What happens there is that as current goes through, one of the electrodes gets metal ions deposited in it all the time, and these ions actually grow into trees. They become trees, very tree-like objects. And this is modeled by a process called diffusion-limited aggregation, which is a very well-posed mathematical object. I'll talk about it later a little bit. Another process of that kind is penetration of a liquid into porous media. Again, this is a very applied in a sense. There's a oil extraction industry is paying a lot of attention of how to get more and more oil out of the deposits, and they do it in three stages actually. So first they drill holes and oil just comes out of there by itself. That's the first stage. The second stage is they start trying to pump it out by sucking it out from the same well, and it still works for some time, but then it stops. But there's still plenty of oil down there. So what they do, they drill a hole nearby and start pumping water in. And this water displaces the oil, and oil comes out of the original well. And so when water is pumped into this rock formation, which contains a lot of oil, it actually spreads very non-uniformly in shape of fingers. And this is called viscous fingering. And the shapes of these clusters and their sizes and scales are, of course, very important from the applied point of view, but they're also very non-trivial in terms of theoretical understanding of them. And there are very well-controlled experiments how to look at them. And so this is all these things are roughly related to what has become known as Laplacian growth. And the reason being is that the sort of solutions of Laplacian equation in some complicated domain determine how the evolution happens. So that's why it's called Laplacian growth. Okay, let me give you another example. Turbulence. Of course, we all have some vague ideas about turbulence. We don't know that, you know, if you pump energy at large scales, it becomes, well, in three dimensions at least, it's sort of transferring to the smaller and smaller scales in terms of some kind of vortices. And these vortices form very complicated patterns that we have not a very good understanding at the moment. And, okay, let me give you another example. String world sheets. So this fluctuating string, it propagates, it sort of sometimes makes these pants, whatnot. And related object that I would consider to be also random shape that I want to study, well, or somebody wants to study, maybe structures from quantum gravity. And specifically, I put 2D here because I don't know if anyone can say anything about other than 2D quantum gravity. Maybe I'm wrong, but so typically people think of some kind of surfaces that are being triangulated, and these triangulations are dynamical; they somehow move. And okay, so these are examples of shapes, and. So geometric questions about them would involve, as I said, dimensions, scales, areas, volumes, and so on. Now, the word stochastic, in my mind, evokes actually two things. So stochastic, first of all, it means, I think, random. And random, again, it's not a very well defined word. Typically, it would mean that shapes are drawn from. So first of all, shapes are complicated. Sometimes, very often, they're fractal shapes. And what's more, they're drawn from some probability distribution. And sometimes this distribution is very well known, sometimes it's not. And so one of the typical goals in this business is to find probabilities of different shapes and find the whole distribution. It would be the ultimate goal, but sometimes you are happy even to do less than that. And so having this random setting allows to use probability tools and ask probabilistic questions. So that's one of the aspects of the stochastic geometry that comes to mind right away. So this is very prominent in the SLE that I'll explain in a few minutes. But the second aspect that I'm not sure, maybe it's not, for me, stochastic not only means random, but also evolving. Typical use of this word is stochastic process. Okay, so so with these shapes, we usually have them not as static images, but they're somehow evolving. And then one can ask questions about what is the dynamics. And this time evolution in different settings has different meaning, really. Sometimes it's really real-time dynamics. These growing clusters do really grow, and we want to understand how this growth happens. The StatMech models, of course, there's no real-time. There's no real-time dynamic. But nevertheless, this new way of looking at them, SLE, introduces some extra variable that is like time variable. And the general description is that of a random time evolving process. So these are two aspects of this stochasticity. Okay. Now, these two examples, the 1 and 4, share a very important aspect, which is called conformal invariance. And the story about conformal invariance, of course, is very long and very old, but it boils down to the following, that essentially in the study of critical phenomena, people have realized that scale invariance somehow plays a big role. And then later it was realized that if you allow scales transformations to be local, that's at different points you can rotate and stretch your system differently, then this allows for much bigger set of transformations called conformal transformations, essentially transformations preserving angles between two curves. And these transformations form a finite group in three and higher dimensions. They somehow correspond to analytic functions in two dimensions. So two dimensions plays a special role in the theory of critical phenomena because two-dimensional conformal invariance happens to be very powerful. So, and because of that, there was a tremendous progress in the study of critical phenomena in two dimensions. And that's why I will concentrate on two dimensions, because this is the best understood area, and SLE specifically applies to this case as well. So let's restrict ourselves to two dimensions. This is also a natural area from the string world sheet point of view. Okay. Let me now describe in more detail what these clusters are about. So let me imagine an Ising system, Ising model. So if you forgot what it means that there's a classical energy which is proportional to the product of Ising spins on nearest neighbor sites, I and J, with some constant over here, and the constant is negative, meaning that the spins are favored if they're pointing in the same direction. So I'm considering a simple ferromagnetic Ising model. And so then, of course, when we have finite temperature, it weighs different configurations differently, and we make a snapshot of this system in the statistical ensemble, we'll have clusters of plus and minus spins that are surrounded by some curve. So vaguely speaking, I'm kind of drawing these clusters like that. I don't distinguish up and down right now. They're just drawing their boundaries. And this is a very complicated ensemble. Typically, people in the past were focusing on the properties of local observables in these systems. They could study correlation functions like spin-spin correlation function. Spin at one side, spin at a different side, and the you look at the expectation value over this ensemble, thermal ensemble. And interestingly, these correlation functions have, of course, special behavior at the critical points. They decay as power laws. There's no scale involved in the system at that point. Now, since we're talking about stochastic geometry, we might want to actually look not at the local observables, but at the boundaries and clusters themselves. It's not such a clear-cut distinction, actually, between the local correlation functions and cluster boundaries, the connections between the two are known, but superficially they look like completely different and unrelated things. But let me just point out that, for example, you want to study this correlation function from the point of view of the boundaries. What would you do? You would sit at this point I, and you'd look at this point K, and you would say, okay, essentially I need to know how many times the spin changes sign as I go from one point to another. So if I draw a line, I count how many times I cross a boundary, and every time I cross a boundary, I go from plus to minus. And so different configurations with different numbers of crossings would contribute different terms into this expectation area, right? So more or less, if I know the distribution of all the loops in my system, I would be able to calculate this function. It's a very difficult way of calculating this function, but nevertheless, the connection is definitely there. The complication in this particular example is that there are enormous number of loops in here, and the infinite, well, when the lattice size goes to zero, there's really infinite number of loops, and you don't really know how to control them all. So one thing that comes to mind, and it has been quite instrumental to the development of SLE, is to concentrate on just one critical curve. I will call these loops critical curves. They're not necessarily loops, as you can see. So what people do routinely these days, they say, let me subject my system to a special boundary condition. That is the following, that I will force all the spins on the part of the boundary to be up by hand. This is just my boundary condition. And I force all the spins on the rest of the boundary to be down. Then no matter what happens in the bulk, between these two points on the boundary that separate these two boundary conditions, there will be a curve that connects them, the interface. At zero temperature, this interface will be straight. There will be nothing else in the system, just this straight interface. As you increase the temperature, there will be, of course, islands of upturned spins. And this curve itself will be sort of wandering off this straight path until eventually at critical temperature, it will become a very complicated fractal curve. But what's important here is that one can study this single curve without paying attention to these other loops in the system. So this is the main object of study in the SLE business, this one particular curve drawn between two points on the boundary of a critical system. Okay, so now it's definitely clear that this is geometric shape. It's random in some sense. It's drawn from some probability distribution. So what about time evolution? The time evolution is present here in a very elegant form in the following way. Let me actually switch to another system that exhibits the similar pictures, except that it's simpler to present. And that is site percolation on triangular lattice. So the system is defined as lattice of sites that is triangular for reasons of its convenience, essentially, and you also know the exact location of the critical point in the system. And what you do, you randomly and independently from everything else, every site can be assigned a color. I can make it white or can leave it black like that. And then you call a cluster the collection of, let's say, white sites that are nearest neighbors. Okay. And I'm looking at these clusters. They're similar to Ising clusters, except that there's no interaction between the sites. Each one of them is independently turned white or black with independent probabilities that are, just number, some parameter in the system, analogous to temperature parameter in the Ising model. So it's known that when this probability p, little p, is 1/2, exactly 1/2, it's the first. Let me step back and describe the phenomenology to you. So if this probability is small, then very few sites will be turned on, and they will typically be disconnected, and the cluster will be small and finite. As the probability increases, typical size of the cluster increases as well. It's like the correlation length in StatMap problems. And then at some point P, critical point P, we have first appearance of infinite cluster. Just infinite cluster appears, and this happens at P equals 1/2, exactly P equals 1/2 for this situation here. That's one of the reasons this is chosen to be a representative example. Now, if I draw this in a slightly different manner, I can choose to represent these sites by hexagons, actually, by drawing these cells around the each site, and then we'll have a system of hexagons and each hexagon now is turned black or white, okay? And I have definitely a boundary between white and black hexagons. If my system has a boundary now, which is simply in this representation some ragged shape like this, I can do the same trick as here. I can force all hexagons to be white on one side and leave them black on the other side of this particular point. And then there will be a line separating these two things, starting exactly here. So this is analogous to this point over here. And then the time evolution here is introduced in the following way. I just draw the first step. That's my first time step. And then I simply look at this site in front of my path. If this site is black, I turn left. If this site is white, I turn right. That's my rules of the evolution. So at every given step, I just simply have a very simple rule whether I'm turning left or right. Okay? This path has to go to infinity eventually. And because, I force all my boundary sites to be white and black, and they only connect at infinity if you want, and at another point where the boundary condition changes. So this curve separating this white and black hexagons has to go to infinity. And that's the curve I want to study. So in some sense, there's a very simple evolution rule here that depending on the outcome of what happens to be this particular site in front of me, I turn left or right. The same similar rules can be invented for all two-dimensional StatMac models that we're familiar with, Ising model being one of them. And in each case, this particular line can be built step by step in this, in this discrete time process. Now, the particular feature of these curves that we want to model is that we believe in their conformal invariance, right? What does it mean here? One thing is that, for example, here I defined my curve on a domain which was bounded. Here I defined my curve on a domain which is unbounded, but they have the same topology. The interior of this disk-like object and the upper half plane have the same topology, and they can be transformed into each other by a conformal transformation. So what we mean by conformal invariance here in this case for this particular situation is that if we have one domain and I produce a curve in this way, it has a certain weight in this statistical ensemble, right? Certain probability, let's say, in a discrete setting. And I perform a conformal transformation, and I get a totally different shape. This curve will have its image over here, right? And I can say that I'm studying an Ising model over here, and I'm studying an Ising model over here on this system. given these two boundary points, correspondence under this conformal map, I create these boundary conditions as described above, and I can ask for the probabilities of different curves in this shape and in that shape. And the statement of conformal invariance is that the weight or the probability for this particular curve should be equal to the weight of its image under the conformal map. Okay. That's a non-trivial statement. It's not a definition. You know, you just have to really simulate on a computer, if you want, your Ising system, draw all possible configurations, you know, put them in the bins, find the distribution, find the probability of this curve and that curve, and compare them. And you will see whether the conformal invariance holds or not. Okay? So we believe that it does. Okay. Now suppose it does. Then there's now a great statement, which is a theorem due to Odette Schramm, that there's one parameter family of conformally invariant continuous simple curves in this situation. And this is called SLE sub kappa. This parameter that describes them, this kappa, will be introduced very shortly. But let me just tell you, it's a very powerful statement because it tells you that if you expect your system to exhibit critical curves, conformally invariant curves in the continuum limit, then they must be one of the SLEs. Okay? Okay, so now let me switch gears and try to describe to you how this SLE works and what this is. I don't mind if people ask questions. So if anybody wants to ask anything, good. Okay, so let me now switch to completely mathematical setting. So I want to describe the following situation. Suppose I have the upper half plane with a curve drawn from its origin and going to infinity eventually. So this curve is going to be parameterized by some real parameter, t, goes from 0 to infinity. Now this is the time that I corresponds to these time steps in my construction over there. And so a particular point in this curve will be denoted gamma sub t. Okay? So one way to describe this geometry is to specify a conformal map that removes this part of that curve. So removes in the following sense. I can make a cut along this curve up to this point, and I can undo it by a conformal transformation, meaning that if I go now around this, along the boundary of this slit domain, how it's called, in this way, I can map this whole domain, so it's upper half plane, minus the curve from 0 to t is being mapped to the upper half plane without any cut. Okay, the transformation that does it, let me call it g sub t. And one reference point that is important is the image of this tip, gamma t, where we sort of turn around. Again, just to make connection right away here, this point is sort of similar to the insertion of this boundary changing condition. Okay. Sorry, this is not gamma of t. This is the image of gamma of t. And traditionally it's called psi sub t. Okay. Now, this map always exists by Riemann theorem. It's not unique in general, but it can be made unique if you request that as z in this upper half plane goes to infinity, we have asymptotic behavior that is, and I mean, again, I'm skipping a lot of things. I can, hopefully we'll have pedagogical introductions to SLE that will explain these things. But if you fix the first few coefficients of this Lorentz expansion at infinity, this becomes a unique map with this property. Okay. Now, in any situation like this, the domains that you're mapping can be changed as you move along this curve. The parameter t changes, and the Loebner equation from from 1923 describes the evolution of these maps. It's actually very easy to derive it. I'm not going to do it here today, but anybody interested is welcome to ask. Let me put this Z here, back here. Z is the, and this evolution is simply a parameter. For every point over here, point Z, you have this equation. Okay. So it's an equation for the map, actually, not. Okay, that's it. This is Loebner equation. Okay, the main object of study in SLE, if you want. It's subject to the initial condition that in the beginning nothing happens, so it's just the identity map. And also, you can think of it. So this is an ordering differential equation in time. Z is again just a parameter, but it's an important parameter in the sense that for some Z's, this denominator becomes singular at some point. It goes to zero, and then after that you cannot run evolution for that particular Z. For a simple curve like this, this Z is just any point on this curve. As soon as you run into this point, you have to stop. For this particular point, the evolution stops. It's not part of the domain that is being mapped anymore. Okay. So you have to understand this. Sometimes this equation, okay, so what's the correspondence? Given a curve, you can always find a real function psi of t that corresponds to this curve according to this equation. You can try to run it backwards. Given a real function, you can study what happens if you try to solve this equation. And the interesting story about this is that you not always get curves. You get some more complicated objects. Sometimes you can have singularities in this function that produce the touching events. So you can have something that grows an arc, and then when the arc touches the real axis, this whole area under the arc gets enclosed and swallowed somehow. It just disappears from the mapping region. So sometimes you grow objects that are not curves, but that's going to be important for the stochastic aspects of this evolution later. Okay, so this is just the general setting for description of curves in terms of conformal maps. Now, what do we want to have in addition is this conformal invariance that is being illustrated here. So Schramm's argument is that if you want to have this property precisely formulated, again, I'm not going to do it here, but if you want to somehow make it more precise, this statement on conformal invariance, then you have only very few choices for this particular driving function. And one hint at how this is done, you might think of trying to evolve your curve in steps, and at every step you perform an infinitesimal conformal transformation that undoes only a small portion of this curve. And to satisfy this conformal invariance requirement, these conformal maps have to have independent distributions and have to be identical independent distributions. So there should be some kind of Markov property and stationarity property of this process. And that translates this into the same properties of this driving function. So what ends up happening is that this psi of t, if you want for conformally invariant curves, psi of t must be standard Brownian motion with the strength that is square root of kappa. I don't know how to write kappa, let me write it this way. Well, In physics language, I think that corresponds to the following, that psi dot is the white noise with the diffusion constant, if you want, kappa, and delta correlated in time. Okay, that's the translation in the physical terms. Okay, so any curve you can think of in this Ising model, percolation, cluster, random cluster models, Bots models, ON models, whatnot, is going to be one of this SLE kappa. So now SLE stands for stochastic Loebner evolution. And Schramm was the inventor of this thing, so some people say equally well SLE can stand for Schramm-Loebner evolution. So Odette Schramm is going to present, well, this discovery, and well, it's sort of, well, it really has been made in 1999. Since then, a lot of people worked on this, on trying to extract various useful properties of this process and relate it to physics. And there are still quite a few open questions that Schramm is going to present to the International Congress of Mathematicians in Madrid. I think it's not next week, but the week after next week. And he has a paper that is sort of open problems in this field, more or less. He summarizes them, explains how. So it's quite interesting to read. Point of view of the inventor of this story. Yeah, it is on the web. Yeah. Now, why is this so great? Well, I told you already one very strong result, that whatever conformally invariant continuous curve you have, it must be one of these SLEs. But what's more, from a more practical perspective, what happens is that, suppose now you do the following shift. Now, define a function f of t, which is g minus psi of t. Then the evolution of this function will look like this. So this looks like a Langevin equation. Okay. So Langevin equations are something that physicists have been dealing with for ages, and we know how to deal with them. We know how to write, corresponding Fokker-Planck equations and solve them. Typically, this involves, depending on, So the only strange thing about this is that it's a complex equation. So it involves complex functions. So it's really two coupled equations. Okay. Nevertheless, one can deal with this, and one can build up the whole, use the whole apparatus of the theory of random processes, stochastic processes, to find answers to various questions about the curves. So let me give you a few illustrative examples of what can be done with this. What are the typical questions? So you can have your cluster with these boundary conditions. And again, since we have conformal invariance now, we don't have to be using initial domain. We can use always the upper half plane or some other suitably defined domain. And this is our critical curve. So what's an example? So we pick up a point, z naught, let's say. And in some realization of this random process, this curve will happen to be to the right of this point. In some realizations, it will happen to the left of the point. So I can ask, what's the probability that the curve is to the right of z naught? That's some number, right? This number depends on kappa, the only parameter that we have at our disposal, and also on the position of this point z naught. So this is a typical probabilistic questions about the geometry of this domain. And so the answer is known. And it's obtained simply solving, I mean, asking some questions about this process and solving it. And it involves some hypergeometric functions. I'm not going to give you details here, but it's very easy to derive, really. Essentially, basically solving some kind of Fokker-Planck equation coming out of this. Another question comes back to John Cardy's crossing probability. So you can have your critical system in a bounded domain now, and you can specify boundary conditions that's slightly more complicated than these, the ones over here. For example, you can, for the percolation problem, you can ask all the sites to be white here. Is John present? John, I always wanted to know whether it's important to have the free boundary condition or fixed with the opposite sign. Is it, they're two different questions, right? Probably you want to have free boundary conditions. Yeah, yeah. So you ask these sites to be white.
It doesn't matter because if you go one row in, then it's
white. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So locality plays. Yeah. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay. But for simplicity, let's just assume that these sites are fixed now, and the sites on the horizontal boundaries are not fixed. They're free to do whatever they want. So we populate them with this probability p and 1 minus p. And then we can ask whether there's a cluster that spans this system from left to right, whether it's a cluster of white sites that goes in between somehow. And this is not a trivial question. I mean, I told you that at the critical point there exists an infinite cluster, but if you try to sort of move this frame around in our infinite system, it's not obvious that this infinite cluster will span this particular sites, this particular size of this system. So it's a non-trivial question. So what's the probability that the cluster spans? And so in a conformally invariant system, it will only depend on the ratio of width to the length of this domain. So it's a non-trivial function of this ratio. Now, I didn't tell you what kappa you are supposed to use here for, if you want to define it. By the way, so John found the answer to this question using conformal field theory, which he had to guess, really. I mean, I think it was not, it was a guess, was it not? It was a guess. It was a very clever guess, but nevertheless, it was confirmed extensively by numerics. Now we know how to derive these things rigorously from SLE. But one has to know what the kappa is for this system. So this brings me to one point that for mathematicians, I think it's still a very important task, is to identify what statistical mechanics model correspond to what value of kappa. We have a very good understanding for some of the systems. In fact, we have a formula that relates kappa to the central charge of a conformal field theory that describes the critical points. I don't know. I can write it for reference. It's actually an interesting formula. So C corresponding to a certain value of kappa is 6 minus kappa, 3 kappa minus 8, divided by 2 kappa. And again, it's sort of, it's very natural number in terms of, so the plot of this thing is that the special values here are 6, 8 third, so let's see, I want to have 2, 4, 8, 8 third is slightly above 2, kappa equals 2 corresponds to C minus 2. Kappa equals 8 also corresponds to C minus 2. At 4, there's a maximum corresponds to C equals 1. And there's a whole, you know, whole range of things in between. Okay? And it vanishes at 8 thirds. And so this is roughly the curve. Okay? So the question that mathematicians would love to answer is, what are the statistical mechanics models that correspond to all of these values of kappa and central charge? So the results that are currently known rigorously this point, cup equals 6 is percolation. is site percolation on triangular lattice. That's to be precise. I mean, it's open question. What we physicists believe in universality, of course. We say, who cares whether it's triangular lattice, site percolation, bond percolation. But for mathematicians, the rigorous statement is that it's been established only on the triangular lattice for site percolation. There are a few models that are known to correspond to C equals 1 and kappa equals 4. I can formulate them easily, but the probably most interesting one, and the one which has more extensions to other cases, is the Gaussian free field. Essentially, you take just free boson theory, massless free boson theory. So it represents just some configuration of, you know, scalar function in two dimensions that is governed by the gradient phi squared term in the action. And then you look at the level lines of that set, of that field. You just, you know, cut it with a horizontal plane and look at the level lines. So the level lines are SLE kappa equals 4. Again, you have to be, one has to be more precise than that, but roughly speaking, this is what it is. And it has extensions to other values of kappa as well. That's okay. I'll come back to it. So SLE as such does not allow for C greater than 1. There are some twists and modifications that can be used, but it's some extra thing. So we know how to model using this language, stochastic language, SU2 Wessemino models at any level, but unfortunately other groups are not yet known. Okay, so now what are the other things? So 8, kappa equals 8, so this is percolation, right? Percolation. 8 is uniform spanning trees. This is something that Gadi Kosma explained last week, but not everybody was there. So essentially, what you do, you consider, let's say, a square lattice, and on this lattice you can draw a spanning trees. Trees are graphs that don't have any loops. That's one definition. And spanning trees means that they visit every single vertex of the lattice that you want, right? Is that clear? And then uniform means that you throw them with equal probability. So each tree has an equal probability. That means uniform. So uniform spanning trees is an interesting object. And in particular, they have a path. So if you have such a tree, there's always a path that goes around it like this. And in a sense, it's a very tightly wound curve. I have better pictures on the computer, of course, if anyone wants to see them. This curve happens to be in the continuum limit to represent a space-filling random piano curve that goes through every point in the plane. Okay, it's space-filling, and that corresponds to this. It's an SLE curve of kappa equals 8. It's very interesting, strange beast. And correspondingly, there's some duality here that you can observe with your naked eye. For every value of C, there are two values of kappa, which are dual to each other. And dual values are kappa and 16 over kappa. This duality, I'll explain to you what the geometric significance of this, but in this particular example of the uniform spanning trees, the duality works like this. Again, take a single tree, and two points on it will always be connected by just one single path. Because there are no loops on the tree, you can only go uniquely from one point to another. The ensemble of this path between two given points is called loop-erased random walk. I mean, it happens to be the same as loop-erased random walks. And again, this was the main motivation for Schramm to introduce this evolution in the first place. And finally, it was proven that this is indeed the SLE with kappa equals to 2. Now, this thing, 8/3, corresponding to C equals 0, is conjectured to be a self-avoiding random walk. Well, and okay, so there are other things which I don't want to take your time about. Okay, so now let me try to give you the geometric meaning of this duality. So I didn't tell you actually the properties of SLE that deserve a separate, you know, long lecture. But one interesting basic property is that, as I told you, if you choose the driving function psi of t arbitrarily, you do not necessarily get simple curves. So what happens with SLE is that SLE has different phases depending on the value of this kappa. If the noise strength is small, namely kappa less or equal to 4, then you get simple curves, which, again, this is a probabilistic statement. They do not bend back on themselves and on the boundary. They just evolve straight lines. So this is like self-avoiding random walks. And, you know, I'll come back to their dimensions in a second. So in the range between 4 and 8, what happens is that once in a while, this curve can bounce back and close. This is a very cartoonish way of representing things, because these are nowhere differentiable curves, really. They're not smooth. They're continuous, but not smooth. Nevertheless, they can have double points. They can touch themselves, bounce back, and the second it happens, this whole region gets excluded from the mapping. Okay, so, and what you grow is hulls in this case, and these are, you know, objects of that sort. So you can have probabilities, non-zero probabilities of enclosing whole two-dimensional regions of the space. And this corresponds to percolation, by the way. Percolation, if you look far away from the cluster, the boundary of the cluster is very, it's touching itself all the time, and the boundary as well. And finally, for kappa greater than 8, you have all these piano curves that, you know, that wind around and fill up the space densely. I don't even know how to draw them. Well, I mean, simple drawing would be simply, you know, color the whole region. But what's interesting is that you, for any kappa greater than 4, you can define sort of local, you can think of a local behavior of the boundary of this cluster, okay? And the conjecture is that the local behavior of this boundary corresponds to the dual kappa. Okay, so kappa greater than 4 gets mapped to kappa less than 4 under this duality. So in percolation, people know about this story a long time ago. So there's what used to be called percolation hulls are the curves with rather high fractal dimension, and those are the curves that are allowed to go deep inside the smallest openings in the clusters. But if you close the small openings, you get much smoother curves that are called external perimeters, and these are exactly the ones corresponding to the dual value of kappa 8 third, and are equivalent to self-avoiding walks. Yes?
What if you did the dual for kappa 8?
So roughly speaking is that this curve has still a boundary at any finite time, right? So this boundary becomes smoother and smoother as you increase kappa. So it becomes, smooth and smoother curve. I didn't mention the following. So for the curves themselves, there's a fractal dimension is known. And the fractal dimension is the following. It's 1 plus kappa divided by 8 for kappa between 0 and 8. And it's 2 for any kappa greater or equal to 8. Okay. So the smaller the kappa, the smoother the curve is. Okay. Now, of course, you can ask what's the connection to conformal field theory. Because we know that all these two-dimensional critical points have very well established description in terms of conformal field theory. And there's not a simple answer to this. Again, the answer to this would require a separate lecture. I can tell you that there are a few ways of connecting these things. One of the first ones was introduced by Bauer and Bernard, and they both are going to be here at some point. And it focuses on the way of connecting these two things is based on some special processes associated with SLE called martingales. This is a word that mathematicians invented. So historically, I think probabilists can correct me, but martingale is something to deal with gambling. It's a game, or a rules in the game, where you, both parties have equal chances of success, more or less, right? It's somehow, but translated into modern mathematical language, a martingale is a stochastic process whose mean is not evolving, roughly speaking. It's not a precise definition, but a martingale is something which, if you average over all the realizations, will be constant in time. And those processes are special because they correspond to conformal field theory correlation functions. And again, this can be explained very clearly, but I'm not going to do it right now. So this is one of the bridges between the two theories. Another way of dealing with this is to realize that there are objects in SLE that have very close correspondence to the Coulomb gas description of any conformal field theory. So interestingly enough, when you deal with this thing, you have to forget about the unitarity condition that people usually worry about. Coulomb gas allows you to describe all of these conformal field theories on equal footing, more or less, if you don't worry about the infinity of states. So there are objects in SLE that are very naturally related to Coulomb gas description of conformal field theories. And I'm running out of time, so let me just briefly mention, just 5 more minutes, if you allow me, to mention the following, that SLE is just one very well-studied class of evolution processes in two dimensions. I want to mention that conformal invariance was very strong condition that really made this unique and very powerful. But in terms of using conformal maps to describe two-dimensional evolution, this whole picture goes much farther. So for example, you can describe the diffusion limited aggregation using the same ideas. Let me tell you what diffusion limited aggregation is about. So diffusion limited aggregation is the following. You take a particle, a seed, and it's sitting somewhere. Then you release another particle from far away, and that particle is diffusing. And when it hits this particle, it gets stuck. Then you do the next particle. It diffuses, gets stuck here. And it happens many, many times, and you grow a very complicated tree-like structure. So what's so beautiful about this? So first of all, the evolution of the cluster is controlled by hitting probabilities of various places on the cluster. And those are related to, you can think of them as being physically, you can think of this as being a metallic cluster charged with some charge. And then the electric field near different parts of the cluster is what controls the likelihood of the attachment to the next particle. Okay? So near the branches where they're sticking out, the electric field is pretty high, and so the probability is much higher over here. So if your structure is like that, then you almost never go deep inside. You almost always attach to the tips. And that develops into a very complicated pattern that is invariably quite universal. You can tweak a lot of details of this process. You will get a cluster which has the same fractal dimension, which is a numerically well-known number, but there's no analytical theory for it whatsoever. So I'm just trying to contrast two things. Some of the geometric shapes that are stochastic and evolving, we understand very well from various points of view, from CFT, from Loebner evolution. There are some other processes that produce equally complicated and interesting objects that are not understood at all. So this is some further interaction between math and physics people can focus on these things and bring understand them better. Another pattern of this sort is Laplacian. That's true. Conformal maps have been applied even before SLE was invented, actually. So Levitov and Hastings introduce a discrete iterative procedure of using conformal maps that attach a blob to a circle, essentially, and use it repeatedly. You have to be careful about the where you put it and what size of the blob you're using, because that really depends on. So this can be described. No. Because you see, this is, nobody knows. That's the answer. The simple, naive answer would be no up front, because if you make the size of these particles to be zero, nothing will grow. Right? So there's definitely a cutoff that introduces a length scale. Without this length, conformal invariance would require no length scale at minimal. At the, you see, the SLE doesn't have length scale.
Conformal invariance is like your percolation of a limit. So the length is zero.
Exactly, that's what I'm saying. So SLE is conformally invariant with no cutoff. Nobody knows. It has not been established. That's the statement. Well, there is a limit, there is no limit. Nobody knows.
So what I was saying is all these lattice lines are only conformally invariant in the limit, they're not conformally.
That's correct. But you see, what is the way to take this limit here? Even how, in principle, how you think of taking this limit? What would you do? As your size of the particle shrinks, and nothing grows. That's, I mean, you have to have a finite size particle to grow something. How to do it? So there are various ways of. Okay, there are continuum models which have no structure, no microscopic cutoffs, like Laplacian growth models, where you start with a blob of water in two dimensions between the two plates. And you start pumping water in, and so the velocity of the interface, normal velocity of interface, is proportional to the gradient of the pressure outside. Okay, this model has no microscopic cutoff, but it develops unwanted singularities at finite times. If you have something that sticks out, it eventually grows to a cusp. In physical situations, this cusp is regularized by the presence of surface tension. And so if you do it hard enough, instead of forming these cusps, actually the finger that grows splits into two. And the branches that evolve out of this resemble the DLA branches very, very much. Nobody understands the relation between the two processes again. There's some very mysterious correspondences between these two things. What I wanted to stress here, though, is that the technique of conformal maps is very well suitable to describe these things. In fact, the Leovner evolution can be very easily generalized. Let me just do it in a few seconds here. So let me write this whole thing as the integral of the real axis with a delta functional, input here. Now you can think, okay, one can start growing, instead of one curve, one can start growing many curves. That would involve, again, this can be done in several different ways, but roughly speaking, what one has, you have the sum over several inputs placed at psi I of t now. So there are several functions that drive this process. This is known as multiple SLEs, and there are various ways of defining them, and there are various criteria, which one is better, which one is not, and so on. But again, roughly speaking, this guy is now the integral over dx, sum over I, delta function, and in principle, one has to introduce some coefficients here. Let me just call them rho i's. What this represents is a discrete density concentrated in certain points. But I can make it a uniform, not uniform, but smooth density. I can replace this whole thing by some density that can be a function of time and coordinate x. And that will cause growth, not in single points, but in a whole domain. So the whole boundary will be moving with time. This is called Leovner chains. This generalization is called Leovner chains, and I definitely can introduce a Leovner chain that corresponds to this growth process, to any growth process you can imagine. Except that these objects are much more complicated than the SLE, so studying them would probably be a very good idea in a more deep way. So there will be mathematicians who are experts in this field here. I guess I should wrap up here and ask if there are questions. Yes?
Can you There, I must have missed something, because there's a sort of obvious puzzle in my mind that if I take an arbitrary conformal field theory independently of C, choose two conformally invariant boundary conversions, and make an interface, I would have thought the curve is conformally invariant, because everything else, all the inputs is conformally invariant. And that would then seem to suggest it should satisfy this equation, but you've told us that's impossible unless C is less than or equal to 1. So...
Okay, so first of all, so let me, let's, so I can give you a twofold answer to this. For one thing, when we start with lattice models, we definitely know what we mean by this interface, right? It has some certain description in terms of spins or, you know, cluster boundaries or whatnot. When you start with an abstract conformal field theory, what is the geometric object that you're looking at? You're just saying you insert a boundary changing operator there. But what does it create? I mean, you have no clue, right? So, and that was one of the problems that we were facing when we were trying to think of generalization to Wessel-Minna models. So the one case when we do know what happens is that in SU2 level K Wessel-Minna model, the boundary changing operator really corresponds to switching between the conjugacy classes on the boundary. And so geometrically, your field, which is sort of the matrix, it reaches some limiting value on this side and some limiting value on this side. And when this curve evolves, the same happens on the sides of this boundary. So it's something that where the conjugacy class just jumps. Now, what happens is that their description evolves degrees of freedom other than this conformal map. The evolution involves the rotations in the group space as well as in the conformal map space. And the only part of this evolution is responsible for the geometry of the trace itself and corresponds to C less than 1. So there are other degrees of freedom that take care of the rest. Yeah. Yes.
Since the longer evolution is an equation for G, which is a conformal mass,
yes,
as you said,
yeah,
and this is supposed to be useful even for systems which don't have...
Absolutely,
matrix.
Absolutely. That's my claim. Yeah. So uses of conformal maps and conformal invariants are completely different in that sense. So that's the statement. Yes. Yeah.
For things like the Wessel-Minna model, which is something probably greater than 1, and is there any of this useful? Can we identify curves?
Well, as I said, I mean, so what has been done is only SU2 level K. There are some difficulties with higher groups, but...
But those are minimum. Oh, sorry. Okay, so one aspect of this is that you...
Yeah, it's like a bosonization in a sense, yeah. Mm. Yeah. Yeah.
What happens if you go in the other direction and go backwards from a psi that isn't
running? Right. So there are attempts of this sort. So there are several issues. One can think of modifications in different aspects of this process. So first of all, so what was required of this Xi of t? It had to be continuous to describe a curve. It had to have independent, identically distributed increments to ensure conformal invariance. And it has to have a symmetry between t and minus t to really, you know, left and right. So you can discard these things one by one in arbitrary order. So for example, one can ask, in field theory, you can definitely define massive field theories, just going off the critical point a little bit. And, well, sometimes these perturbations lead to very interesting integral theories, right? And so you can ask, is there a geometric SLE-type description of those field theories? And naively, one would think that it must be possible, but if you think about it, again, naive answer would be that as soon as you introduce some kind of length scale into the process, you can consider not white noise, but the colored noise with some correlation that is not delta function, but has some scale. Or you can even say it's a piecewise constant process that jumps at certain times. It's like a discrete approximation to a random walk, to Brownian motion, a random walk. Then what grows is not a curve. It has to have some limit as the jump size goes to zero in a certain way. And that would be appropriate. It's sort of a model of renormalization group flow from this critical point to the ordered phase or disordered phase in SLE language. This has been looked into somewhat, not very much, but there's some results known. But naively, as I said, as soon as you introduce length scale, you break conformal invariance. That's the simple answer. So you definitely go to some phase, which if you go all the way, would naively correspond to just simply a straight interface. So there's nothing interesting, no interesting geometry happening there. Mm-hmm. Unless you take care of staying close to critical points in a controlled way. So I don't know how to do it. And this has not been studied, really. Another thing is that you can abandon the idea of continuity of this thing. You can still work in the continuum time, but the process can be jumping. And if you insist on having independent, identically distributed increments, you are left with what is called Levy flights. And the SLE driven by Levy flights has been studied. I mean, so it's a subject that mathematicians already looked at, and so there's some results there. I don't know how relevant it is to any field theory, but as a mathematical random process, it's probably interesting. And yeah, you mean some? Well, as I said, so as soon as you try to, the Schramm's theorem is very powerful. You know, it's really a uniqueness theorem, right? Not only existence, but uniqueness theorem. So if you try to avoid, if you try to go away from it, you will break one of the axioms of SLE, and then you will have either non-simple curves, not curves, or you will have not conformally invariant curves. So that's...
At the beginning, you had this list of problems, and
yes,
you showed that it's relevant for...
I forgot to mention, sorry, so thank you for reminding me. I was running out of time, so I was not sure if I had a chance to say that. So in fact, so one of the beauties of SLE is that it has been used as a tool of probing conformal invariance in systems where we didn't know whether they were supposed to be conformal invariant or not. So there are three examples in the literature that I know of, and they're all very beautiful. The first one of that kind was turbulence, two-dimensional turbulence. People have made massive simulations of two-dimensional turbulence, and they looked at very specific lines, namely lines separating the vorticity regions of plus and minus sign. So vorticity is, you know, is characterizing how these swirls are going this way or that way. So vorticity is a function of position. It has, in two dimensions, just simply a scalar function. So you can look at the domains of positive vorticity and negative vorticity. Amazingly enough, with extremely high accuracy numerically, it has been established that that the boundaries between the zero positive and negative vorticity are SLE kappa equals 6. And Denis Bernard, who is going to come here, is one of the authors of that paper. He'll explain to us what this is about. So another example of that sort is spin glasses, two-dimensional spin glasses. This is a system which, on top of the Ising interaction, has also frozen randomness. So this is, again, this is a subject of a separate, I hope there will be a separate Blackboard talk on the random systems. But imagine that you have some ensemble where the interactions are random. And then even the ground state is a complicated issue. You can have multiple ground states which are degenerate, and there are a whole issue of how system will fall into them as you cool it down. So there are a whole bunch of issues related to spin glasses, which is very complicated. But nevertheless, again, there was some numerical work which suggested that the boundaries of clusters of the spin glass Ising model were, again, some SLE curves. And it's not simply saying that they probed local things. They probed global things like crossing probabilities, and those, and did it in different geometries to see whether it's conformally invariant or not. Six. Yeah.
But that's a rather big conclusion, isn't it?
No, I don't think so. So, okay. No.
If that equals 6, it just means that like the left and right vorticities are thrown down at random.
No, but that's not true. It's definitely known that the vorticity field is not Gaussian. That's for sure. because they know that they have non-trivial correlations between three-point functions, for example, vorticity field, are non-zero. It's a very non-Gaussian process. So that's so they were lucky to stumble upon a very specific line. If you look at the other level lines of the vorticity field, they are not SLA at all. It's a mysterious thing. So, in fact, conformal invariance in turbulence has been a subject of massive. Well, I mean, Polyakov was hoping to develop conformal field theory of turbulence some time ago, and it never went anywhere, right? And until this new breakthrough, I think there's some hints that there may be something there. And the third example is some chaotic maps. There's a paper by John Keating and company studying some version of Kick-Trotter, and they have phase space where they have some domains, again, the phase space, that are separated by lines, and these lines, again, happen to be SLA. I don't remember what kappa is, but I mean, this. No. So the statement is that they have some curves that they can probe some properties of. And, for example, they can, look at the crossing probabilities. There's one. It's not a number. It's a whole function. So if you can vary the aspect ratio of this domain, and they have the function that fits to the numerics, at all the points, very difficult to imagine what else can it be. Yeah.
So SLE6 has this locality property.
That's true.
No reason for locality property in this context.
No. So in fact, okay, let me take it back. For spin glasses, I don't remember precisely what kappa was. I should look it up. But for the turbulence example, it was 6. Oh, what? Very close to 6. Again, the best fit was 5.9 something. But don't ask me. It's a very wide open question. No, I don't think anybody believes that localities play, unless you formulate in some specific language, but not that I know of.
Okay, well, we can continue to ask questions, but do you see any applications for string
theory? Okay. So I forgot to mention another thing which is probably sort of starting answering in this direction. So the KPZ formula in not Kardar Parisi-Zhang, but Knizhnik-Polyakov-Zamolodchikov formula in quantum 2D gravity can be now understood from the point of view of SLE in some way, or if you want Coulomb gas formulation of CFT. And that's, I don't know if this is helpful or not, but somehow it's a new perspective on the things that, I don't know. There's no quantum gravity involved in that calculation. It's just some. So the basic formulation is the following. You have this cluster, this critical cluster, and you can ask what the multifractal moments of the harmonic measure is, are. So physically defined, you charge this cluster, and you look at the distribution of electric field near this cluster. It's very rugged. It's a multifractal. So you can look at the moments of this distribution, average of the cluster, and they scale in a certain way with non-trivial exponents. Each moment scales with a non-trivial its own exponent. It's called multifractality. And so those multifractal exponents are given by KPZ formula. And that can be understood in various ways. But so Schramm actually points to this KPZ question as an open question in SLE in his lecture, in his talk.
Okay, let's do it again.